uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
Another live edition of the Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. This is the Thursday evening edition, morning edition, however you want to look at it. Thursday, April the 28th, going into the 29th now, and it's officially Friday, right? Yeah. Well, there you go. So if you made it all the way to Friday, officially give yourself a pat on the back, crack a cold one, roll a fat one, do whatever you do. And here's to you. So thanks for being with us tonight. We are going to be getting into various topics of discussion. We'll be getting into a few news stories tonight. You know where I stand there. But honestly, conveniently enough, there just isn't enough important things to even cover. The news is so ridiculous. I'll be getting into a few select, let's put it like that, select news stories here tonight. And we'll also continue reading from William Bramley's The Gods of Eden, chapter 27 for you here tonight. Here a night, there a night. And that's what the name of the chapter is. Here a night, there a night. So here a night, there a night tonight. Chapter 27, William Bramley's Gods of Eden. We'll be picking up there and reading tonight. Continue. He has these. I like how he sort of puts the chapters where, you know, he'll talk a lot about alien stuff, and then he'll kind of go back to the historical stuff, and then he does sort of tie it all together. So we'll be continuing reading there tonight. So thanks for being with us, and thanks for staying up late with us. We'll also take your emails. If you have any topics of discussion, anything you'd like to have me discuss, would love to hear from you, and I'll be happy to read any of those on air and talk about them here on the show. GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com. That's GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com. The website where this broadcast originates from is www.theglobalreality.com. It's theglobalreality.com. So there you go. There's our website, and everything is up there on the website for you to do with the films and with radio show archives, greatest hits, clips. There's all kinds of their music from the Demigods, the band. Jamie Reeves, Delphi, there's all kinds of stuff up there you can do at the website. Somebody else say that Chip and Banner was giving them issues tonight. Again, you know, where this is our fundraising week, we need to meet the goal we have set on the Chip and Banner this week to pay the bills. And again, if you have problems with that, feel free to send me an email, globalrealityshow@gmail.com. Maybe we can see what the problem is. But another email address I'll give you that you can use for the direct PayPal email address, if you want to use this to have a PayPal account, and the Chip and Banner and the donate button won't work for you. You can send an amount, any amount you want, to your PayPal account. You can just send, like, say you go under the tab that says send money, and then you select an email. It'll have like a box that pops up, and you select an email, and you can just put this email address in there. Get a pen and write this down if you're having problems with that. dayglow76@yahoo.com. dayglow76@yahoo.com. So, so if you have any problems or anything like that, just, you can just use that. So there you go. I had somebody else say that they're having problems with it. So I don't know. I don't know what to think about that. I don't know whether to think that there's something nefarious going on. You know, you can't help but think so. But then again, it is technology we're talking about here, right? It's made by us, so it certainly is going to have its flaws, no matter what it is. Funny how that meme has found its way into, you know, science fiction, Terminator, Tron, or The Matrix, whatever have you. But it is something you find to be true, isn't it? You know, you can't make a perfect computer system that can run everything efficiently, because mankind is not perfect. So, you know, but at the same time, we're not perfect because they won't allow us to be. So that's kind of a cop out in a way, because, you know, we don't even have one inkling of an iota of what we're capable of, because we have been generationally kept down and kept, you know, pushed down and downtrodden and kept from being able to find what our true potential is. Because again, something about our true potential seems to be the biggest threat to these elite bastards running the planet. So, you know, that's kind of a phony construct too, the idea that, you know, we can't build anything. Well, yeah, with the Earth and the planet and humans how they are now, no, we can't. Everything is imperfect. But the unlocking the secrets of what we're capable of, which is really one of the, if not the biggest secret of the elite rulers, because again, keeping us in ignorance about what we're capable of and what we can do, and keeping us dumbed down and programmed from a very early age, keeps them from maintaining power indefinitely. So, you know, again, that's something to bear in mind when we talk about that. You know, yeah, it's easy to say humans couldn't build anything perfect or build a perfect machine and blah, blah, blah. No, well, we couldn't, because we've been kept in a state of arrested development generationally for centuries. And so until we can break through that and find out how to bring ourselves the rest of the way, we're never going to be able to create anything worthwhile. See, they create all this death and this war and this destruction, and then they use the cop-out of, oh, well, that's just how humans are. No, that's just how you bastards have programmed us all to be. Let's tell the truth here. But they get us to believe that because they've been doing this to us, what they don't understand is that we now know and understand that they've been doing this to us for an extremely long amount of time. And once you do something to a people for centuries, literally on end, you know, millennia, that starts to be programmed into a human being's characteristics. It's the same thing how, you know, certain cats, and, you know, cats were kept indoors and kept in palaces and all kinds of stuff, and that's why they carry that trait with them to this day if you have an inside cat. Well, they figured out the same thing about humans. If you kept them in a constant downtrodden state, they wouldn't ever know anything other than that. And that's exactly what they've done. So, yeah, humans are only bred to destroy and create war and everything. Yes, because that's all they've ever allowed us to know for centuries. So it has become what we are on this planet, but it's not all we are capable of. And the problem is that those things, those constructs, are being supplanted onto us artificially. We've never been allowed to see what we could do free of their influence. They don't consider that even a possibility. But it has to be a possibility somewhere, in some universe, in some dimension. So why don't we attempt to try and manifest that into ours, into our own? It's possible. Anything's possible, right? What's holding it back? Our minds. Our belief that this illusion is the only thing that is real. And anything that attempts to get in the way of breaking up that illusion, we see as a threat. That, again, that's the programming. We've been programmed to believe that these things that are coming in from outside, be it, you know, people like myself who do radio talk shows or make films or, you know, people on television and media or whatever else, that's what it's designed to do. So, we've never been able to see what we're fully capable of because they haven't allowed us to break out of their artificial enslavement. We don't know what's possible. But there is possibilities that exist beyond their controlled paradigm. That's a fact. We just have to allow ourselves to break free from the illusion that their world is the only world that can be real. Let's see what we have it in the email bag tonight. I don't think I had any. I got this one earlier. I want to read. This is from Mitchell. He says, this is a funny email. He says, oh, for fuck's sake, I can't take my eyes off this dumb fucking football draft. Now they rolled out the servicemen and women on stage to dose the sheep up with some good old patriotism, the power of the NFL. I wonder how many team owners are CMP members. I'm sure you have some NFL elite connections you can share. Then again, this will probably bore the fuck out of you, which you will gladly tell me on air. No, it's not. No, that's not bore the fuck out of me. I got, I'll talk about that here in a minute for you if you like. He says, hi, that's what I like about you. You are you're like the honorary friend a guy would share beers with in the garage, get into arguments, and then drink more beer. Hey, as long as you pay for the beer, I'm down for whatever, you know, it's cool. I love your show and your sincerity, keeping it real. And by the way, have you narrowed down the possibilities of the next film topic, occult music and music, baby, full tilt reptilian boogie. Right on. I'll be coming out with all that stuff later on down the road. I'll have the poll and everything out. That won't be coming out for a while, but, NFL elite connections. Well, what do you want? I mean, you can look at it from its very base element. And what is football and all this crap at its very base element? Roman gladiatorial distractions, right? You know, just like they had in the olden days of Rome, and they had the gladiator battles and all that stuff. And that's what this modern day football stuff is. And coincidentally enough, all of the guy who started the NFL was a Hunt, Lamar Hunt, from the Hunt Oil family. All Knights of Malta, all the way across the board, going all the way back to their father, H.L. Hunt, who had paid for the John Birch Society to put those flyers around Dallas on November 21st, 1963, the wanted for treason posters. He had been working in closely. He was a good friend of Guy Bannister, who was played by Ed Asner in the JFK movie. H.L. Hunt was good friends with him. He was also John Birch Society. Clay Bannister was, and he was another guy who was involved with working with the Castro ops and all that stuff. But Lamar Hunt, son of H.L. Hunt, he started the AFL, and then they started the there was the AFL and the, I guess it was AFL and NFL or AFL and American Football League and National Football League or what it was. It was two different leagues. And he started that, and he started the Kansas City Chiefs. And I think later on he had a hand in working with, the Dallas Cowboys and had a hand in bringing the Dallas Cowboys to Dallas. Big player. I heard a thing with Jerry Jones, the owner of Dallas Cowboys, one time. And he said that when Lamar Hunt, he first met Lamar Hunt, he was going to buy the San Diego Chargers from Lamar Hunt. And he said he picked him up at the airport, and he said he treated him like he was royalty. And I said, well, yeah. Because Jerry Jones, of course, even back before Jerry Jones, back when in the days of Tom Landry, I read some stuff one time where it was talking all about, I can't remember, it was on some website a few years ago, it was all about Tom Landry was a Council for National Policy member And there was a big controversy in the 80s when Tom Landry made the team in the locker room say a prayer. And a lot of these guys, you look like Roger Staubach, famous quarterback for the Cowboys. He came out of Notre Dame. That guy's big time in business. A lot of these guys back in those days were Freemasons. A lot of them still are. There's intimate connections to people like Jerry Jones and the NFL owners who are all in the Knights of Malta. And so they have connections back to Rome and the Vatican there. And so that, to no surprise, lo and behold, the people who are the owners of the modern day gladiatorial distractions have connections and roots, ladies and gentlemen, back to the originators of Roman gladiatorial distractions. And it's a fact. All these guys, they're all Knights of Malta, all the way across the board. Jerry Jones, I don't know how many of the current NFL owners are. I don't know. I don't want facts and figures on that. But I know it's been a part of the good old boys network, connected to the mob and connected to, you know, running the numbers in Vegas, running the numbers in Atlantic City and all that stuff. All of the football sports stuff, it's all connected to back with the Knights of Malta, with the mob, back to Rome. It's a big racket, man. They run it all. They control it all. So I hope that answers your question there, Mitchell. So thanks so much for that tonight. But we're going to jump into some news here. Let's see what we have here tonight. Arachnophobes, beware. America faces... this is an interesting thing now. America faces soaring numbers of its most feared spider, and climate change is to blame, in parentheses. Well, that's pretty presumptuous. I mean, I like for you to get to your presumptions in the article, maybe not in the headline, you know, Daily Mail. Thank you. They are one of the most feared spiders in North America, and now the brown recluse. The spider population is growing and predicted to expand into northern states as a result of climate change. Now, I'd like to know exactly how they define climate change, because yes, the climate is changing. But see, now they're so vague anymore because they've changed the definition of what climate change really means. It's not global warming anymore. It's climate change. And so climate change has become this even vaguer term, because how they define climate change varies from who's saying it. I don't know if you guys have noticed this. A lot of you probably have noticed this, but if you haven't noticed this, it's absolutely true. The terminology, the definition of what climate change means now differs depending on who's saying it. So, for instance, if it's Al Gore or one of these, you know, global warming pushers, climate change means global warming. And all the fear-mongering, all the doom and gloom that they told us was going to come with it, which is, in many cases, proven to be a fraud. Now, on the other hand, not global warming or man-made anthropogenic global warming, let's forget about all that. Climate change is a completely different thing because, again, the definition of that is going to change depending on who's telling it, because some people are going to give you part of the story. Other people are going to give you another half of the story, and probably neither one of them are going to give you the entire story. So whoever is using the term climate change has the ability to manipulate that phrase for it to mean what they want. But what they have people believe is they created this thing by changing it from global warming to climate change. Now that where your average everyday, you know, dumbed down citizen just thinks that climate change is global warming, but that's absolutely not true. It doesn't always mean global warming. The climate is changing. It does change. That's a fact. Again, this goes back to the secret knowledge that they have of these natural cycles that happen with the planet, with the stars, the alignments of the stars, other things that may take place on our planet, great changes in our physical bodies, in how we perceive dimensions can happen from where the location of our star is. Look into there's a great documentary, The Cygnus Mystery. You should watch that. So that kind of stuff. They're aware of all of that. So we have a few things here that deal with this phony definition of climate change here on these first couple of stories. But they're saying climate change is going to cause the brown recluse spider to break out in larger numbers. Researchers are predicting the population will expand in parts of Nebraska, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, South Dakota, Ohio, and Pennsylvania by 2080. The spiders tend to build their webs in woodpiles and sheds, cupboards, and other places that are dry and generally undisturbed. If they get inside the house, they often favor cardboard, but have also been found in shoes, bed sheets, and infrequently used beds. in clothes stacked or left lying on the floor inside work gloves behind baseboards and pictures and near sources of warmth. When provoked, the brown recluse injects a powerful venom that in rare cases can kill. In some cases, the bite can kill the skin tissues of the site, leading to a painful sores and deep scarring. So they're saying that, so that climate change is going to cause the spiders to break out. Now, they've already been saying that all of these tornadoes and this crazy weather that's been going on was a result of climate change. You know, there's already been people that were saying, oh, climate change, that's what's causing this. I'm Al Gore, story here out of France24.com and via the AFP. Tornadoes whipped up by wind, not climate, say officials. U.S. meteorologists warned Thursday that it would be a mistake to blame climate change for a seeming increase in tornadoes in the wake of deadly storms that have ripped through the South. Now, as I've said several times in the in some of the more recent shows we've done here, and I want to hammer this point home again because there's kind of a little qualifier on there that this just reminded me of that I needed to put on top of that. I've been saying to you here in subsequent shows that, you know, if you believe that there's weather warfare going on right now, and that's what all of this stuff is, you know, the earthquakes and the tornadoes and all this craziness, that you'd be justifying in holding that belief based on the evidence of the, and what we know of the technology and scalar weather weapons and warfare and all this stuff. So that would be, you know, you'd be justified in having it. And then on the other end, if you believe that this was a part of these cyclical changes, things that tie into galactic alignment, the sunspot cycles, solar minimums, solar maximums, and that these are all these tornadoes and earthquakes and all this craziness is a part of these natural changes going on, and that's what climate change is too. And there isn't a weather war going on, but you believe that, you know, it's these cyclical changes, you'd be justified in believing that too. But that's two choices for, you know, that those are two things that if you're already awake to this stuff, you're going to find. What about everybody else out there who hasn't even got to those two choices? Because the mainstream is not offering those two choices, are they? No. What is the mainstream offering for an explanation to all this stuff? The majority of people believe this stuff, as this article says here, believe that the earthquakes and the tornadoes and all this craziness are being caused by man-made global warming. So you see, that's a problem. Because those of us who are, you know, wow, how lucky are we? I mean, my God, you know, we only have to decide whether what conspiracy to pick, because either one, it's probably are probably correct. But the mainstream of people out there don't even, they don't get a chance to choose from that. They just believe either, and some people are going to believe, oh, yeah, it's the end time, son. That's what it is. It means the end is near. Yes, sir. God is coming back on his magic carpet. Mm-hmm. You know, some people believe that's the end time, but the majority of people believe that it's, you know, this is climate change. This is what they've warned us about, climate change. And then that's reinforced in the media, isn't it? So that's a real problem. And that really gets to the root, I believe, of why they have been creating this phony hysteria around global warming, is to keep us further from the truth. And the whole divide and conquer thing of, you know, is it real? Isn't it? And, you know, the climate gate papers and all that. Now, all that stuff was a red herring too, folks. Because the bigger issue here is that they know full well what's causing this, and it's not the explanation of what is really causing this is not being offered up to the general public. Well, it needs to be. Spread this far and wide. Take my words, take what I've said here tonight, spread it far and wide. We need to have this in the conversation to everybody. The general population thinks this is either the end times playing out, or this is global warming and climate change, or possibly both. I'm sure there's a handful of crazy nut radical religious freaks out there that believe that global warming is a result of God punishing us. You know, I'm sure there is.
Suck Satan's cock. Suck that shit.
Tornadoes whipped up by wind, not climate. If you look at the past 60 years of data, the number of tornadoes is increasing significantly, but it's agreed upon by the tornado community that it's not a real increase. It's having to do with better weather tracking technology, more population, and the fact that the population is better educated and more aware, so we're seeing them more often. But he said it wouldn't be a terrible mistake to relate the uptick to climate change. It wouldn't be a terrible mistake. Well, I think it would be a terrible mistake. I mean, the whole thing about about the climate change stuff is being based on a phony premise. They're not giving us anything near the real explanation. It's one of two things. Either there is a massive weather war going on right now, and I'll tell you what. I'll tell you why I don't think that there's a massive weather war right now. If the United States of America was what we're all programmed to believe it was, and the powers that be believed that and really cared about this country the way that they act like they do on TV, which we know is a lie, do you think we would be in the position that we are in right now with China? With them holding us by the balls? You know, with a sharp pair of scissors just waiting to just snip them off any day, anytime they want? Do you really think if we were in the middle of a weather war, we'd be in this position with China? Because, look, folks, if China was as big a threat as we're being programmed to believe, and I'm not even saying China doesn't have power and China isn't the manufacturing base of the world, because it is, and it's now the world's largest economy. But if these sons of bitches in charge really cared about America the way they claim they do, they would zap these motherfucking Chinese in the middle of next week with HAARP and all kinds of scalar weather weapons, so they would make fucking Japan look like Disney World. Is that going to happen? Probably not. What problems would it solve? Well, we'd probably get some manufacturing base going back in this country again, since China's taking it all over. Want to talk about fixing the economy overnight? Oh, man. Let's just say conveniently, China, what happens in Japan happens in China, but on a much larger scale, and wipes out their manufacturing base. There are no product manufacturing around the world. Somebody's going to have to pick up the slack. Boom, there, America's economy comes back overnight. We didn't even have to have a war to do that. So that tells you right there, folks, since that hasn't happened and isn't going to happen, that these cocksuckers in charge that claim they're all about the red, white, and blue in America don't give a rat's ass about America, because if they did, they'd pull the trigger on their scalar weapons and knock out their manufacturing base and take over the reins again. We are not being ran by people in this country who give a rat's ass about the country or its people or anything else. Period. End of story. End of discussion. No room for argument. What else do we have here tonight? Oh, by the way, also a little add on to that. They also said that these tornadoes were the largest and strongest that have ever been recorded in history. So, you know, again, maybe there is weather warfare going on. Rare sideways tornado captured on video. Again, maybe there is weather warfare going on. Crazy, crazy stuff. What else we got here tonight? Not a lot of news. Oh, check this out. Superman renounces U.S. citizenship in Action Comics number 900. After recently undertaking a journey to walk, not fly, across the United States in a grounded storyline and reconnect with the country and everyday Americans, Superman appears to be taking another step that could have major implications for his national identity. In Action Comics number 900, Superman announces that he is going to give up his U.S. citizenship. Despite very literally being an alien immigrant, Superman has long been seen as a patriotic symbol of truth, justice, and the American way. From his embrace of traditional American ideals to the iconic red, white, and blue of his costume, what it means to stand for the American way is an increasingly complicated thing, however, both in the real world and in the superhero comics, whose storylines have increasingly seemed to mirror current events. Well, they always have. and deal with moral and political complexities rather than simple black and white morality. The key scene takes place in The Incident, a short story in Action Comics number 900 written by David S. Goyer with art by Miguel Sepulveda. In it, Superman consults with the president's national security advisor, who is incensed that Superman appeared in Tehran to nonviolently support the protesters demonstrating against the Iranian regime. Oh, my God. You are got to be kidding me. They're putting this kind of shit in comics now. Oh, man. Wow. It's hilarious. And I knew this was happening because I started hearing, I hear from people who are teachers and stuff. And like, I hear from people who teach and people who, you know, work with kids and stuff. And I'm not kidding. Literally, I've heard so many stories now of people that see, you know, 16, 17 year old kids and stuff, 15, 16 year old kids in like, you know, Alex Jones shirts, InfoWars stuff. And I started figuring out that that's like his target demographic now, because that's where they're shooting for. They're aiming this new right mindset that they've created with the Truth Movement and the Teabag Movement, and they're merging it together, and they're going after the young kids by putting it in comic books and putting it in video games and putting it in movies and all this stuff. And they're baiting this the younger generation into this stuff at a lot younger age than they did during my generation. I lucked into this stuff at like 16, you know, because I just happened to, well, I started researching UFOs and they bring me to Triangle and I was in third grade, son. That's no shit. I'll never forget it, man. 1986, I'm reading books on, you know, anything I can get my hands on UFOs, and I was into it forever. I was into it since I was a kid. But it's crazy what they're putting in this stuff now. However, since Superman is viewed as an American icon in the DC universe, as well as our own, the Iranian government has construed his actions as the will of the American president and indeed an act of war. Superman replies that it was foolish to think that his actions would not reflect politically on the American government, and that he therefore plans to renounce his American citizenship at the United Nations the next day. This is fucking insane. My God, it's just right here, right? I mean, see what they're trying to do there. This is programming, folks. All of this stuff, because again, we're at the time period where the energy is here. It's around us. The energy for a revolution, a true revolution of the people against the powers that enslave us, is here, right within our grasp. But that energy is being hijacked and led into these phony revolutions, and these phony, the Ron Paul revolution, or the phony Barack Obama revolution, or whatever it may have you, the phony teabag movement. And they're funneling it down so this gets seen as, you know, a people's revolution of rising up against the people without the people even having all the facts about who it is they're really going up against. This is so dangerous. I never would have dreamed that when I first started exposing the CMP and stuff and all these, you know, the phony patriot movement, never would have dreamed that it would have the implications that it does now. I mean, there's a reason why, I was supposed to find this information and stick with it and stay with it and continue working with it and trying to get it out there. They're trying to hijack our energy. They're trying to funnel it into a phony controlled revolution. Once again, I think that there's something to do with psychical changes in the rotation of the earth around the sun and the planetary alignments and star alignments, where the energy is on a such a level for revolution that they have to hijack it and take it over. I believe that's what happened in the 60s. I believe that there was, because of the shifting as we're moving into a new age, and right about that time was when Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote his book, Between Two Ages. That's exactly where we are right now. We're between two ages. So the energy of the old age and the energy of the new age are pulling both of them are pulling at us constantly and will be pulling at us constantly and have been for something like the next few hundred years. That's a long time in the lifespan of a person. So we have all of these energies pulling at us. We have the energy of the new age pulling us this way, the energy of the old age pulling us the other way. Then at certain times, this energy is peaking. And at those times when this energy is peaking is when we have an opportunity to step up for mankind and say no more. And the last time we had this energy rising like this was in the 1960s. And what did they do then? They set up these phony movements. They put all of the, you know, they made all of the figureheads of the musicians, you know, the mamas and the papas and the Frank Zappa, all, Jim Morrison, all these, you know, all of these rock stars and the heads of the hippie movement at that time, all their parents were high-level ops in the federal government. Fact. The whole Laurel Canyon scene. Look into it. They're doing it again. This time they're going to do it with the phony truth movement, patriot movement, Ron Paul thing. That's why they were getting so many young kids into Ron Paul the last go round. They're programming him at a young age for their final takeover here. Can't you see? That's why they're putting this stuff in the goddamn Superman comic books now. It's mind blowing. It's absolutely mind blowing. And then silver hit the high since the highest it's ever been since when? 1980. What happened in 1980? Well, it's in the Secret Right Volume 1. The Hunt Oil Brothers got all of their, what was essentially the Truth Movement, Patriot Movement at that time, the John Birch Society movement. They got all their John Birch Society cronies to buy silver. The government passed a new law. They tanked it. The Hunts lost $1 billion. It didn't affect their solvency one bit. And these liars go around saying, oh, the Hunts lost their money to take on the bankers and they're heroes. We need to be like the Hunts. Yeah, be like the horse breeding Hunts who brought the Rockefellers into Dallas. You know, give me a fucking break, you idiots. You guys are fucking exposed. This information's out of the bag now. Unbelievable. What else we have here on the news front tonight? We're going to get through all this in one shot. This from Wired Danger Room. Drones spray and track the unwilling in Air Force plan. Wow. Well, any article that starts like that's got to be interesting, right? Here's how the U.S. Air Force wants to hunt the next generation of its enemies. A tiny drone sneaks up to a suspect, paints him with an unnoticed powder or goo that allows American forces to follow him everywhere he goes until they train a missile on him. On Tuesday, the Air Force issued a call for help, making a miniature drone that could covertly drop a mysterious and unspecified tracking dust onto people, allowing them to be tracked from a distance. The proposal says it's useful for all kinds of random things, from identifying friendly forces and civilians to tracking wildlife, but the motive behind a covert drone tagger likely has less to do with sneaking up on spotted owls and more to do with painting a target on the backs of tomorrow's terrorists. Effectively tracking foes has become a higher priority and deeply secret research effort for the Pentagon, which has struggled at times to sort out insurgent from innocent in places like Afghanistan. The Navy has a $450 million contract with Herndon, Virginia's Blackbird Technologies Incorporated, to produce tiny beacons to make terrorists trackable. By terrorists trackable, they mean you and I and everybody trackable. Understand that. Don't let them pull that over on you. Don't ever let them make you think that any of this stuff is just being created for whatever goddamn enemy they're telling you is the enemy now, this week, this month, this year, this century, this millennium. The Defense Department has been pouring serious cash, $210 million that they'll admit to find advanced new ways to do this so-called tagging, tracking, and locating work, as Danger Room co-founder Sharon Weinberger noted in Popular Science last year.
Salt Satan's cock.
The research he cataloged is as mind-boggling as it is varied. Ideas range from uniquely identifiable insect pheromones to infrared gear that tracks people with their thermal fingerprint. One company, Voxtel, makes tiny nanocrystals that can be hidden in clear liquids and seen through night vision goggles. A 2007 briefing from the U.S. Special Operations Command on targeting technology stated that SOCOM, Southern Command, was looking for perfumes and stains that would mark out bad guys from a distance. The presentation listed a bioreactive tagget as a current capability next to a picture of what looks like a painted or bruised arm. Another tracking technology is smart dust. a long forecast cloud of tiny sensors that stick to target human or his clothes. And that seems to be what the Air Force wants its mini drone configured for. The solicitation floats the idea of dropping a dust-like cloud of electromagnetic signal radiating tagants either on top of the target or in his path so that he'll walk into it. To do that, they need to either do some high-altitude crop dusting. I think they got that covered already. This is probably, you know what? This is probably what they've been doing all along, isn't it? With all these, they've probably been dropping this fucking nanofiber tracking shit on us all along. I mean, they're telling us about it now. That means they've had it for 10 years, right? I mean, honestly, isn't that what we've seen? That's unbelievable. This has probably been going on forever. I don't think this is coming. This has probably already been happening, folks. You ever woke up with bruises on your body before not knowing where they came from? I know a lot of people who have. I have. Well, from what this says, that could very well be it. To do that, they need to either do some high-altitude crop dusting. I love that. High-altitude crop dusting. Yeah, is that what you guys call it? We call it chemtrails, but, you know, call it what you want. High-altitude crop dusting of the target or launch a small munition that would blow out the tagant in midair when it was nearby. It may be a signal that the smart dust technology is at least feasible enough to plan a vehicle around. In her article, Weinberger noted that the DARPA-funded researchers had drones that could drop clouds of tagants the size of a grain of rice as early as 2001. What did I tell you? Shabanga! When you're hot, you're hot. When you're not, you're not. I said they probably had this shit for 10 years. Probably been using it for 10 years. Boom, there it is. Yeah, they always admit to stuff 10 years later. They did the same thing with the X-37B. That pilotless drone thing that looks like a UFO. I remember showing that to people 10 years ago, saying, guaranteed they got this now. Guaranteed they've already had this. We'll hear about it 10 years from now. And then, what was it, a few months ago? They said now the X-37B is being rolled out and being used. And, oh, by the way, it has a particle beam laser built onto it. What the fuck? Oh, man, yeah. Weinberger notes that DARPA-funded researchers had drones that could drop clouds of tagants the size of a grain of rice as early as 2001. It's hard to say for certain, but accounts of drone targeting tech from Taliban and Al-Qaeda leaders indicate that the current tracking beacons, which rely on radio frequency pulses, radar, or infrared flashes, pale in comparison to some of the proposals. According to statements from a Pakistani Taliban commander, the U.S. gives local spies tracking chips in their cell phones in order to train Hellfire missiles on militants. The battery-powered infrared beacons that Al-Qaeda says it found spies using are a well-known technology that dates back at least to 1984. Isn't that convenient? What form will the Air Force dusting drone take? The Air Force states that the design isn't set in stone. They're open to other innovative methods, so it's as yet unformed, but the references section of the solicitation name checks a 1997 study for DARPA, small-scale propulsion, fly-on-the-wall, cockroach in the corner, which may contain some... Oh, yeah, is that what they're talking about? Like the robot-controlled cockroaches, robo-roach, and the flies, artificially-controlled flies. The study examines the feasibility of micro-air vehicles on the battlefield to deliver a payload of tagants or explosives. It mentions that while animal-like robots would be great, the technology to replicate their movement isn't quite available yet. Al-Qaeda might not want to keep an eye out for strange birds in coming years because one of the companies mentioned in the 1997 study is having promising MAV technology. AeroVironment has been perfecting a robotic hummingbird that can fly remotely for up to 10 minutes. I've seen these things. Me and my sister saw these things. It could only be described. I called it a bird orb. It looked like a flying egg. It's been a few years since I've seen one, but I've seen them on multiple occasions. They look like a flying egg with wings, and they're seen a lot around chemtrails. And one day I saw some seagulls flying around by where I used to work, which was kind of close to the lake, and I saw one of these bird orb things up there that was swirling around. I was like, my God, I'd seen people take pictures and video of it. It just looked so fake. Like an egg with wings, and it was just flying around. And literally, I saw a bird fly up to this thing. When the bird flew up to this thing and saw it was fake, the bird freaked the fuck out, man, and flew away from this thing, hauled ass away from it quick as shit. And one night I heard on, right after I saw this, I had heard a caller, I was listening to Coast to Coast AM one night just on a whim. I happened to be listening to it, and I heard a caller call in, and he described exactly, and I mean exactly to a T, what we had seen with these bird orb things that I described. They look like artificial birds. And Snorri laughed him off the air. Snorri said, I don't know what you're talking about. I can't comment on that because I don't know what the hell you're talking about. Probably not real, and hung up on the guy. And I was screaming going, my God, that's what I saw. That's what I saw. So maybe, you know, again, two things in that article may indicate to us that this has probably been going on for a lot longer than we think. They probably track every single one of us and know where every single one of us are at all times. I guarantee they do. Unbelievable stuff. All right, well, we're going to take a break, come back, and when we come back from the break, we'll be getting into William Bramley's The Gods of Eden. If you have any email questions, you can get them in during this break, and I'll be happy to read them when we get back. GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com is my email address. It's GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com, and we'll take a break, come back, and get into more news for you here. I mean, sorry, not more news. We're reading from William Bramley's The Gods of Eden for you here tonight, folks. This is The Global Reality. Stay with us.
We'll be right back. checks for free. We got to install a microwave oven, custom kitchen deliveries. We got to move these refrigerators. We got to move these color TVs. Listen here. Now, that ain't working. That's the way you do it. You play the guitar on the MTV. That ain't working. That's the way you do it. Money for nothing and your chicks for free. Money for nothing. Chicks for free. Money for nothing.
Show someone you love that they are the one. So many ways to express love, it's hard to choose just one. How you gonna do it? Some people like to kiss, some people like to hug. Some lesbians like eating each other's shit out of a cup. Some people say I love you, some even shout it out. Some people puke semi-digested shit into each other's mouths. Sometimes making love's not enough. You have to step it up. And urinating on her face is not enough to say I love you. Some people like to kiss, some people like to hug, some lesbians like eating each other's shit out of a cup. Some people say I love you, some even shout it out. Some people puke semi-digested shit into each other's mouths. She's covered in vomit and human feces. That's how I know that she needs me. She's covered in vomit and human feces. That's how I know that she needs me. She's covered in vomit and human feces. That's how I know that she needs me. Shit in my mouth and I'll puke it all over your face.
All right, back here with you in the Global Reality, right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Thank you for being with us tonight. And we've got more to talk about with you here on the show. And thanks to everybody for tuning in with us tonight. Yeah, a little John Lajoie there for you. If you've never seen Two Girls, One Cup, let me tell you, it's you don't want to see it. That's all I'm saying. Don't Google it. Don't look it up. I watched it so you don't have to. And, yeah, that's all I can say. Anyway, back here with you on the show tonight. And, Sarah had sent me a message saying, please don't get too upset. Yeah, I heard you talking about the stuff last night with the, you know, labeling conspiracy theorists as Machiavellian mindset when, you know, we're exposing the Machiavellian mindset. So if you expose the Machiavellian mindset, you now are a Machiavellian, and you would if you believe that the government blew up the buildings on 9/11, you believe that because if you were the government, you'd do the same thing. Unbelievable doublethink there. So if you were in the government, you'd do the same thing because you believe it was a conspiracy that makes you a terrorist. And then there's also, is that a subtly veiled admission of guilt? Sounds like it to me. She's saying now that there's a video here from MSNBC and they're talking about, you know, conspiracy there suffer from pathology. Yeah, they'll do anything they can. They'll say anything they can. Now we knew it was going to get bumpy. And, this is it. This is all they've got left. But we're gaining more and more information, more and more knowledge every day. And so this is why they're having to resort to this stuff. Also got a message from VK saying, good job with the Brantley interview and that he enjoyed that. Well, thank you, VK. I appreciate that and good to hear from you. And, he said he was taking some time off from listening and doing this stuff because the energy was getting crazy. Yeah, it was. Mercury retrograde was a bitch this go around. I'll say this. So, I don't know, you're doing good. And I like to hear, you know, it's good to hear from listeners sometimes, you know, because sometimes I hear from people and I don't hear from them for a while. And I don't know if I've lost them or I said something they didn't like or whatever. So it's good. I like that. I like when I hear back from listeners, you know, and they let me know they're still out there listening. And every once in a while, I'll get a message from somebody I hadn't heard from in 3 or 4 years, you know, but they've been still been listening the whole time. It's amazing how that works. It seems like the only listeners that we ever really lose are people who, you know, were either ops or, you know, just gone batshit crazy. It's weird how that works. Chapter 27 for you here tonight. William Bramley's The Gods of Eden, Here a Night, There a Night. This is chapter 27. Even after the collapse of the Stuart cause, the Knight degrees remained popular and spread rapidly. The pro-Stuart slant vanished in favor of an anti-monarchical philosophy in some Templar organizations, and a pro-monarchical sentiment in others. Freemasons practicing the Templar degrees played important political roles on both sides of the monarchy versus anti-monarchy battles going on in the 18th century, thereby helping to keep that issue alive in such a way that people would find it something to continuously fight over. For example, King Gustavus III of Sweden and his brother Carl, the Duke of Södermanland, had been initiated into the strict observance in 1770. In the following year, one of Gustavus's first acts upon assuming the Swedish throne was to mount a coup d'etat against the Swedish parliament and reestablish powers, greater powers in the crown. According to Samuel Harrison Baynard, writing in his book History of the Supreme Council, Gustavus was assisted largely by fellow Freemasons. The Knight degrees also found a home in Ireland, where they attached themselves to the Order of Orange. As we recall, the Order of Orange was a militant organization patterned after Freemasonry. It was founded to ensure that that Protestantism remained England's dominant religion. We, the other night on Lee Rogers' show, if you listened to the show Tuesday night, we were talking about the guy that made the Ten Commandments movie, and how that movie was littered with Masonic symbolism and symbolism of extraterrestrials and all this stuff. Well, it was made by none other than Cecil B. DeMille, and you can go and look this up. It's on a Freemason website. I read it on Lee's show the other night. Cecil B. DeMille was a member of the Orange Order of Freemasonry, and he originally made that movie in the 1928, made one version of the Ten Commandments, and then after going through all the different, you know, by the time he got to the 50s, he'd been through years of being in the Freemasons and all the initiation, so he went back and made what he said was the proper version of the movie, The Ten Commandments, which is the one that he ended up making with Charlton Heston. So just to give you a little bit of an idea there of you know, proof that these custodians are putting this stuff into movies and all the rest of this, there you go. Cecil B. DeMille, Order of the Orange. The Order of the Orange was founded to ensure that Protestantism remained England's dominant religion. Members of the Orange Order vowed to support the Hanoverians as long as the Hanoverians continued their support of Protestantism. The Knight degrees were grafted onto the Order of Orange in the early 1790s, by which time the Stuart cause was nearly dead. The Orange Order's Templar degrees were, and still are today, called the Black Preceptory. Although the Orange Order and the Black Preceptory are supposed to be equal in status and rank, entry into the Black Preceptory is accomplished only after a person has first passed through the degrees of the Orange Order. According to Tony Gray, writing in his fascinating book, The Orange Order, the Black Preceptory today has 11 degrees, and a great deal of secrecy still shrouds the inner workings of this curious institution. Approximately 50-60% of all Orange members become members of the Preceptory. The Orange Order itself continues to be strongly Protestant and anti-Catholic, and in this way, it contributes to some of the conflicts between Catholics and Protestants in Ireland today. Another interesting chapter in the history of the Templar degrees concerns the creation of a bogus Illuminati. Now, here we go. This is what I've been talking about, is that the Illuminati that the Patriot Movement, Truth Movement, and people tell you about is not the same Illuminati that has really been having hands in the pie and really controlling things. The whole thing with Weishaupt and all that, that's a red herring. That's not the real truth about the Illuminati, but that's what everybody parrots and believes is the real truth about it, but it's absolutely not. Another interesting chapter in the history of the Templar degrees concerns the creation of a bogus Illuminati. Illuminati, as we recall, was the Latin name given to the Brotherhood. In 1779, a second Illuminati was started in the Strict Observance Lodge of Munich. This second bogus Illuminati was led by an ex-Jesuit priest named Adam Weishaupt. But see, that's what everybody focuses in on as being the real Illuminati, and it's not. It's a fraud. The second bogus Illuminati was led by an ex-Jesuit priest named Adam Weishaupt and was structured as a semi-autonomous organization. Openly political and anti-monarchical, Weishaupt's Illuminati formed another channel of higher degrees for Freemasons to graduate into after completing the blue degrees. Weishaupt's Illuminati had its own hidden master known as the Ancient Scot Superior. The strict observance members who were initiated into this Illuminati apparently believed that they were being initiated into the highest echelons of the real Illuminati or the Brotherhood, but they were not. Once initiated under strict vows of secrecy, members were revealed a great deal of political and anti-monarchical philosophy. Weishaupt's Illuminati was soon attacked, however. Its headquarters in German Bavaria were raided by the Elector of Bavaria in 1786. Many radical political aims of the Illuminati were discovered in documents seized during the raid. The Duke of Brunswick, acting as Grand Master of German Freemasonry, finally issued a manifesto 8 years later in 1794 to counteract Weishaupt's bogus Illuminati after the public scandal could no longer be contained. Joining in the suppression of Weishaupt's Bavarian Illuminati were many Rosicrucians. Despite the repression, this Illuminati survived and still exists today. Many people have mistakenly believed that Weishaupt's Illuminati was the true Illuminati and that it took over all of Freemasonry. I mean, this book was published in 1989, folks, and that's still the predominant view today. And again, this with all this information that's proven in this book that we've talked about here, that's proven the connections to the priest class, to the CMP, to the Jesuits, all of this stuff. I mean, my God, that's pretty huge. People are still putting out movies in 2011 that say Adam Weishaupt started the Illuminati, blah, 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 blah. It's absolutely not true. And I've been laughed at for saying that for fucking years on this show. Ugh. Many people have mistakenly believed that Weishaupt's Illuminati was the true Illuminati and that took over all of Freemasonry. This error is caused by Weishaupt's express desire to have his degrees become the only higher degrees of Freemasonry. One can still find books today which theorize that Weishaupt's Illuminati was and still is the source of nearly all of mankind's social ills. A careful study of the evidence indicates that Weishaupt's Illuminati is actually a red herring in this respect. Hear, hear. Hear, hear. I got to give it up. You know, Bramley said a few things in this book I don't agree with, but I got to say 100% right there. You know, there are still people going around saying that Weishaupt's Illuminati was the actual one. So you got to believe that this is being done by design, especially when you see it being done by these priest class minion bozos like Mark Dice, who are connected into whatever that cardinal's name, the Jesuit Vatican cardinal out in Los Angeles that Alex Jones goes to when he goes out to California. All the Sheen family goes to it. Danny Bonaducci goes to it. Now we know why these clowns have been pushing this phony version of what the Illuminati is on us. So they can create the red herring so the real one is never found. It's unbelievable. A careful study of the evidence indicates that Weishaupt's Illuminati is actually a red herring in this respect. Although Weishaupt's Illuminati did contribute to some of the revolutionary agitation going on in Europe, its impact on history does not appear to have been as great as some people believe, despite the enormous publicity it received. The social ills, which have sometimes been blamed on Weishaupt's Illuminati, existed long before the birth of Adam Weishaupt. What did take over nearly all of Freemasonry in the 18th century were the Templar degrees, which were not the same thing as Weishaupt's Illuminati. The true significance of the Bavarian Illuminati is that it was an anti-monarchy faction allowed to operate out of strict observance lodges. Meanwhile, the strict observance was generally considered pro-monarchy, and it supported pro-monarchy causes, as in the Swedish Riksdag overthrow mentioned earlier. This made the strict observance a source of secret agitation on both sides. And on both sides of the monarchy versus anti-monarchy conflicts, for a number of years, another example of brotherhood Machiavellianism. The worldwide transformation of human society announced in the Rosicrucian Fama Fraternis gained momentum as Freemasons and other mystical network members led numerous revolutions around the world. The uprisings were not confined to Europe. They spilled across the Atlantic Ocean and took root in the German colonies in North America. They gave birth to the single most influential nation on Earth today, the United States of America. So that's the end of Chapter 7. God damn. Boy, I tell you what. I hope a lot of people hear this broadcast tonight. I hope a lot of people hear this on YouTube. We've been having a couple of big pieces of info in this show tonight. But that's definitely one of them, man. If we can get people to understand that this Illuminati and then the Alumbrados, Los Alumbrados Society, and all this stuff, and how it connects to the Jesuits and the priest class, and how these are the real people that are running the show, and how these priest class bozos in the truth movement have given us this red herring Illuminati and told us that that's the real explanation for it, we're going to be able to come a lot farther. But again, proof that the mainstream controlled truth movement is telling us these red herring lies and telling us part of the truth, but not giving us the whole truth. And there it is in a book written in 1989. And ask yourself why you never heard of William Bramley, or none of us really had until recently. He didn't, you know, you never, how come this guy was never brought on, the Alex Jones show or something? Because he doesn't want you to know this info, because that's who the fuck he's covering for. Crazy, crazy stuff. Chapter 28, American Phoenix. American Phoenix. Well, this should get interesting, huh? Let's see how long this is. Yeah, this is a long-ass chapter. Well, we probably won't get through all this tonight, but we can at least try to get through some of it. Let me blow my nose real quick. Hold on. Driving me crazy. Crazy sinus shit. All right. Oh. I need a drink, but I'll soldier on nonetheless here. Let me get some throat spray going. That'll help a little bit. Whew. All right, here we go. Chapter 28. William Bramley's The Gods of Eden, American Phoenix for you here tonight. When European colonists sailed to North America, the Brotherhood organization sailed with them. In 1694, a group of Rosicrucian leaders from Europe founded a colony in what is today the state of Pennsylvania. Some of their picturesque buildings in Ephrata still stand as unique tourist attractions. Freemasonry followed. On June 5, 1730, the Duke of Norfolk granted to Daniel Cox of New Jersey, one of the earliest known Masonic deputations, to reach the American colonies. The deputation appointed Mr. Cox provisional Grand Master of New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, and it also allowed him to establish lodges. One of the earliest official colonial lodges was founded by Harry Price in Boston on August 31, 1733, under a charter from the Mother Grand Lodge of England. Masonic historian Albert Mackey believes that lodges probably existed earlier, but that their records have been lost. Freemasonry spread rapidly in the American colonies, just as it had done in Europe. The early lodges in the British colonies were nearly all chartered by the English Mother Grand Lodge, and members of the early lodges were loyal British subjects. Englishmen were not the only people to colonize America. England had a major rival in the New World, France. The competition between the two nations caused frequent spats over colonial boundaries. This brought about a number of violent clashes on American soil, such as Queen Anne's War during the first decade of the 18th century and King George's War in 1744. Even during times of peace relations between the two superpowers, things were anything but smooth. One of the of Britain's loyal military officers in the colonies was a man named George Washington. He had been initiated into Freemasonry on November 4th, 1752, at the age of 20. He remained a member of the craft for the rest of his life. Washington became an officer in the colonial army, which was under British authority, by the time he had reached his mid-20s. Standing 6 feet 3 inches tall and weighing nearly 200 pounds, Washington was a physically impressive figure. One of Washington's military duties was to keep an eye on French troops in these tense border regions. The Treaty of Aix-la-Chapelle, executed in 1748, had ended King George's War and had returned some territories to France. Both England and France benefited from this pause in hostilities because the war were driving the two into debt. Even the inflatable paper currencies, there I go again, papal currencies. Might as well just call it that, right? I can't even say paper currency anymore. It's papal currency all the time. The two nations used to help pay for their wars did not prevent the serious financial difficulties that wars always bring. Unfortunately, the peace lasted less than a decade. It was broken, according to some historians, by George Washington during one of his military forays into the Ohio Valley. Washington and his men sighted a group of French soldiers but were not spotted by the French in return. On the command of Washington, his troops opened fire without warning. It turned out that Washington's soldiers had ambushed credentialed French ambassadors traveling with a customary military escort. The French alleged afterwards that they were on their way to confer with the British to settle some of the disputes still existing over the Ohio regions. Washington justified his attack by stating that the French soldiers were skulking and that their claim to diplomatic immunity was a pretense. Whatever the truth might have been, the French felt that they had been the victims of unprovoked military aggression. Well, yeah, we've been using unprovoked military aggression since before the days of George Washington. Give me a fucking break. You can't get any more American than that, can you? Why do you think George Washington was known as the greatest American? He was the guy was the first person who was the president to use unprovoked military aggression. It's been the blueprint ever since. The French and Indian Wars were soon underway. It spread to Europe as the Seven Years' War. The renewed warfare was disastrous. According to Frederick the Great, the Seven Years' War claimed as many as 853,000 military casualties plus hundreds of thousands of civilian lives. Heavy economic damage was inflicted upon both England and France. When the war ended, England faced a national debt of £136 million, most of it owed to a banking elite. To repay the debt, the English Parliament levied heavy taxes in its own country. When this taxation became too high, duties were placed on goods in the American colonies. The duties quickly became a sore point with the American colonists, who began to resist. Another change caused by the war was Hanover's abandonment of their policies of keeping a small standing army in Britain. England's armed forces were greatly expanded. This brought about a need to tax citizens even more. In addition to nearly 6,000 British troops in America needed housing, and they often encroached upon the property rights of colonists, this generated yet more colonial dissent. The fourth adverse consequence of the war, at least in the minds of the colonists, was England's catapultation to the demands of several American Indian nations. The American Indians had fought on the side of the French because of the encroachment of British colonists on Indian lands. After the French and Indian War, the Crown issued the Proclamation of 1763, commanding that the vast region between the Appalachian Mountains and the Mississippi River was to be a widespread Indian reservation. British subjects were not permitted to settle there without approval from the Crown. This sharply reduced Western expansion. The first of Britain's new colonial tax measures went into effect in 1764. It was known as the Sugar Act. It placed duties on lumber, food, rum, and molasses. In the following year, a new tax, the Stamp Act, was instituted to help pay for the British troops stationed in the colonies. Many colonists strongly objected to the taxes and the manner in which they were collected. Under British writs of assistance, for example, Crown custom agents would search whatever they pleased for goods imported in violation of the acts. The agents had almost unlimited powers to search and seize without any notice or warrant. In October 1765, representatives from 9 colonies met at a Stamp Act Congress in New York. They passed a Declaration of Rights expressing their opposition to taxation without colonial representation in the British Parliament. The Declaration also opposed trials without juries by British Admiralty courts. This act of defiance was partially successful. On March 17, 1766, 5 months after the Stamp Act, Congress met. The Stamp Act was repealed. Despite sincere efforts by the British Parliament to satisfy many colonial demands, a significant independence movement was developing in the American colonies. Under the leadership of a man named Samuel Adams, a secret organization calling itself the Sons of Liberty began to commit acts of violence and terrorism. They burned the records of the Vice Admiralty Court and looted the homes of various British officials. They threatened further violence against stamp agents and other British authorities. The Sons of Liberty organized economic boycotts by urging colonists to cancel orders for British merchandise. These acts hurt England because the colonies were very important to Britain as a trade outlet. Therefore, in 1770, Britain bowed once again to the colonists by repealing all duties except on tea. By that time, however, the revolutionary fervor was too strong to be halted. The result was bloodshed. On March 5, 1770, the Boston Massacre occurred, in which British troops fired into a Boston mob and killed 5 people. Tensions continued to mount, and more secret revolutionary groups were formed. Britain would still not repeal the tax on tea. On October 14, 1773, 3 years after the Boston Massacre, colonists dressed as Indians crept onto a British ship anchored in Boston Harbor and threw large quantities of tea into the water. This incident was the famous Boston Tea Party. These acts of rebellion finally caused Parliament to enact trade sanctions against the colonists. The sanctions merely fueled the rebellion. In 1774, a group of colonial leaders convened the First Continental Congress to protest British actions and to call for civil disobedience. In March 1775, Patrick Henry gave his Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death speech at a convention in Virginia. Within less than a month of that speech, the American Revolution got underway with the Battle of Concord, where an organized colonial militia called the Minutemen suffered 8 casualties while inflicting 273 on the British. In June of that same year, George Washington, the man who some historians believe had gotten the entire snowball rolling 2 decades earlier, when he had ordered his troops to fire on the French in the Ohio Valley, was named commander-in-chief of the new ragtag Continental Army. Historians have noted that economic motives were not the only ones propelling the American revolutionaries. This became obvious after the British Parliament repealed nearly all of the tariffs that they had imposed. King George III, despite being a Hanoverian, was popular at home, and he initially thought of himself as a friend to the colonists. The sharp attacks against King George by revolutionary spokesmen quite upset him because the attack seemed out of proportion to his actual role and the problems complained of by the colonists. Yeah, they used him as a scapegoat. More of the revolutionary rhetoric should have been aimed at the Parliament. There was clearly something deeper driving the revolutionary cause. Bingo. Bingo. I mean, my God, they... They cooked up and concocted the whole Boston Tea thing as a phony revolution. And these same motherfuckers that are in the CMP and the teabaggers and stuff, they're doing it now all over again, just like I've been telling you for 4 fucking years. And this information's been under my nose, well, in this book since at least 1989. They're doing it again. Unbelievable. There is clearly something deeper driving the revolutionary cause. The rebels were out to establish a whole new social order. Their revolt was fueled by sweeping philosophies which encompassed more than their disputes with the crown. One of those philosophies was Freemasonry. I mean, see, this is, again, oh man, this is unbelievable stuff. A who's who of the American Revolution is almost a who's who of American colonial Freemasonry. Freemasons fighting on the revolutionary side included George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, who had not been a Mason since at least 1731, Alexander Hamilton, Richard Montgomery, Henry Knox, James Madison, and Patrick Henry. Revolutionaries who were also Masonic Grandmasters included Paul Revere, John Hancock, and James Clinton. In addition to Washington and Franklin, according to Colonel Levon P. Lynn in his article Freemasonry and the National Defense, 1754 to 1799, quote, out of an estimated 14,000 officers of all grades in the Continental Army, 1/7, or 2,018, were Freemasons. They represented a total of 218 lodges. 100 of those officers were generals. Colonel Lynn remarks, quote, in all our wars, beginning with the French and Indian Wars and the War for American Independence, the silhouettes of American military Masons have loomed high above the battles. Europe provided the Americans with two additional Freemasons of importance. From Germany came the Baron von Steuben, who personally turned Washington's ragged troops into the semblance of a fighting army. Von Steuben was a German Freemason who had served in the Prussian army as an aide-de-camp to Frederick the Great. He had been discharged during the 1763 Prussian demobilization after the Seven Years' War. At the time that von Steuben's services were procured in Kranz by Benjamin Franklin, von Steuben was a half-pay captain who had been out of military work for 14 years. Franklin, in order to get the approval of Congress, faked von Steuben's dossier by stating von Steuben to be a lieutenant general. The deception worked, much to the ultimate benefit of the Continental Army. The second European was the Marquis de Lafayette. Lafayette was a wealthy French nobleman who, in his very early 20s, had been inspired by the news of the American Revolution while serving in the French army in Europe, so he sailed to America to aid the revolutionary cause. In 1778, during his service with the Continental Army, Lafayette was made a Freemason. Later, after the war, Lafayette revealed just how important Freemasonry was due to the leadership of the Revolutionary Army. In his address to the four of Wilmington Lodge of Delaware, during his last visit to America in 1824, Lafayette said, at one time, while serving under General Washington, I could not rid my mind of the suspicion that the general harbored doubts about me. This suspicion was confirmed by the fact that I had never been given a command in chief. This thought was an obsession, and it sometimes made me very unhappy. After I had become an American Freemason general, Washington seemed to have seen the light. From that moment, I never had reason to doubt his entire confidence, and soon thereafter, I was given a very important command in chief. When we consider the prominence of Freemasons in the American Revolution, it should come as no surprise that revolutionary agitation from Masonic lodges directly, according to Colonel Lynn's article, the famous Boston Tea Party was the work of Masons coming directly out of a lodge. Yep, absolutely true. These same secret societies are controlling the phony revolution and the phony movement today, folks. Wake up. On December 6, 1773, a group disguised as American Indians seemed to have left St. Andrew's Lodge in Boston and gone to Boston Harbor, where cargoes of tea were thrown overboard from the three Indian men's ships. Sven G. London, in his article, Annihilation of Freemasonry, states that St. Andrew's Lodge was the leading Masonic body in Boston. And in the book, which used to contain the minutes of the lodge and which still exists, there is an almost blank page where the minutes of that memorable Thursday should be. Instead, the page bears but one letter, a large T. Can it have anything to do with T-E-A? In Sam Adams' Pioneer of Propaganda, author John C. Miller describes the hierarchy of the anti-British mobs which played such an important role in the conflict. The mobs were not just random aggregates of disgruntled colonials. Mr. Miller explains the important role of Freemasons in these mobs. A hierarchy of mobs was established during Sam Adams' rule of Boston. The lowest classes, servants, Negroes, and sailors, were placed under the command of a superior set consisting of the master Masons and the carpenters in town. Above them were put the merchants' mob and the Sons of Liberty. Masonic lodges were not Johnny-come-latelys to the revolutionary cause. There is evidence that there were initial instigators at least one lodge engaged in agitation from the very beginning. Letters and newspapers from the early 1760s reveal that the Boston Masonic Society was stirring up anti-British sentiment at the end of the Seven Years' War a good 10 years before the revolution actually began. The Boston Masonic Society peppered Governor Thomas Hutchinson and the royal government from its meeting place in Adjutant Trowell's Long Garret, where it was said more sedition, inciting to revolt, libels, and scurrility were hatched than in all the garrets in Grub Street. Otis and his Masonic brethren became such adept muckrakers that Hutchinson's friends believed that they must have ransacked Billingsgate and the stews for mud to sling it at the Massachusetts aristocracy. We might wonder how American lodges became sources of revolt when they were nearly all chartered under the English system, which, as we recall, was pro-Hanoverian and forbade political controversy within the lodges. It must be kept in mind that by the 1760s, the anti-Hanoverian Templar degrees had become firmly established in Europe, and it had also traveled secretly to many of the lodges in the American colonies. For example, as mentioned in an earlier chapter, St. Andrew's Lodge of Boston, which had perpetrated the Boston Tea Party in 1773, conferred a Templar degree already on August 28, 1769. After reapplying for the warrant in 1762 from the Scottish Grand Lodge in Edinburgh, that application was made almost a decade before the American Revolution began. Some Templars were not only anti-Hanoverian, but they also sought the abolition of all monarchy. The philosophical importance of Freemasonry to the American revolutionaries can also be seen in the symbols with which the revolutionary leaders choose to represent the new American nation. They were Brotherhood Masonic symbols. Let me see how much we have left here. Yeah, we're going to go ahead and stop right there for tonight. There's 3-4 more pages left. I'm just out of gas. I don't have enough to finish here. But man, nonetheless, lots of important info on tonight's show. Please go back and listen to this show again. I kind of went through some stuff fast. It'll replay here tonight as well, and well into tomorrow. And then through the weekend, all the shows of the week will replay as well, but it'll be up in the archives. Man, we got to get this show out to a lot of people, man. Anybody can put it up on YouTube and send it around to people. I think there's a lot of good info in here tonight and a lot of stuff that's further proving our case that we've been talking about who's really running the show and who's really in charge. And man, lots of big, important info tonight. Well, man, good show. I enjoyed being here with you guys tonight. Don't forget, please support our work at the website, theglobalreality.com. Hopefully the chip and banner, the donate button or whatever will stop being wonky for you guys. But we have the chip and banner there. We got to meet our goal and pay the bills. And this is our fundraising week. So this will be our final broadcast for the fundraising week. So please help us meet that goal there that's set at the chip and banner, and use the donate button if you want to use anything else, or my PayPal direct email, dayglow76@yahoo.com. If you want to send any other amounts, aren't just for the bills, for, you know, to help us grow and buy better equipment and all that stuff, you can do that there as well. And it keeps us commercial free, and we don't have to resort to selling things and having commercials. And I like to keep it that way. My name is Josh Reeves. I love each and every one of you. And we will see you guys back here next time for the broadcast. You guys have a great night. Take care.